This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This month, the AIDS epidemic passed another awful marker. Over 200,000 cases have now been reported in the U.S., according to the CDC. The percentage of cases among homosexual and bisexual men has dropped since 1989, but the percentage of cases among blacks and Hispanics and heterosexual IV drug users is up. Many experts believe that the reason AIDS is still proportionately on the rise among blacks, Hispanics, and drug users is that they have received less information about the disease. My guest Rashida Hassan is trying to change that. She's the co-founder and executive director of BABASHI, an acronym for Blacks Educating Blacks About Sexual Health Issues. BABASHI is based in Philadelphia and is considered one of the most successful grassroots organizations of its kind. Hassan first became an AIDS activist when she was a nurse practitioner in the field of epidemiology. She worked with an AIDS task force in Philadelphia, but by 1985 she decided the group wasn't reaching much beyond the gay white community.
There was, at that point, a strong unwillingness on the part of the gay community nationally to sort of relinquish AIDS to a broader public health perspective. And I mean, I understand very much that it was, aside from a devastating illness to the community, I mean, clearly the gay community has suffered tremendous losses as a result of this disease, but it also gave them a public forum for other gay rights issues. So there's a give and take with it. But what was clear to me is that when you look at how disease progresses through human populations, people who are least educated and are most socially and economically disadvantaged are often much more severely impacted by these kinds of illnesses.
Who specifically do you try to reach?
Well, BABASHI has had probably multi-phases of outreach efforts. One was to simply alert in general the minority populations, the African-American population specifically, since many of my clients and the constituents we would try to reach are African-American. We also try to target those that are most at risk and least likely to have information. So, you know, we see our intravenous drug users, people involved in sex trade. We also believe that young people, adolescents especially, are going to be at greatest risk and also have the least amount of information based on behaviors. And then we try to then fan out more generally into the community consciousness aware, you know, awareness raising.
I think it must be incredibly difficult to reach drug users, IV drug users who are in the high-risk group. Mm-hmm. When you started going to crack houses, how would you talk your way in? I mean, I'd imagine among the people who are very suspicious of letting in somebody who's not a user themselves is the people who run the house.
Well, that's true, but these are not strangers. I mean, we're familiar with people who do drugs in our community. We're familiar with people who run drug houses. I mean, they're somebody's brother or somebody's cousin, and, you know, you ask, well, who is this? This is Jimmy, you know, and you say, well, Jimmy, I understand that you might be familiar with some people who could use the information I have. I'd like to have a chance to talk. I talk to Jimmy. I might not go to the crack house the first time I meet Jimmy, but he gets to know me a little bit. He sees me around. He knows I'm out on the street passing out condoms, that I'm giving literature, that I've talked to a few people. After he's seen me for a few times, he's a little more comfortable with, oh, yeah, I know who that woman is. She's from BABASHI. I wear my little BABASHI badge, as my staff continues to do. Once you've set up that kind of relationship, the next step is to say, well, I really like to have an opportunity to talk to people who are active, you know. You think that's possible? And it's like, well, yeah, we could probably get you in. And you just trust that person to take you in to do it. It's not a matter of, you know, going up to somebody's door, knocking on the door and say, I understand you sell drugs here. I'd like to come and do some AIDS education. I mean, you really can't do it that way. But it does mean entering into sort of that world and being willing to exchange with the people.
Or drug users willing to listen?
Yes, if you got them just as they were going to make their fix, you know, take whatever
right before,
or as they were preparing to inject, you could get a message in. Your messages have to be short. We're not talking about a 45-minute lecture on AIDS, but while they're preparing, saying, well, you know, we want you to clean your needle with this. This is dilute alcohol or bleach, and we want you to, you know, clean through it three times, and you actually show them how to do it. They draw up their drugs after they've, you know, done whatever they need to do with them and inject them. And we're talking about we've got to wash this out again now that you've used it. It's your needle. Keep it for yourself. And, you know, they'll listen for that. We're talking about 2-3 minutes of conversation, but you try to get back to them as often as possible.
I want to go back to the beginning of the group when you were still trying to figure out how to do this, mm-hmm. how to reach people who were not being reached mm-hmm. by AIDS education. And you decided you needed to reach people who worked in the sex trades. Mm-hmm. So what was your technique for finding them, talking to them, convincing them?
Well, it's never hard to find the sex trade areas in any major city. You just have to kind of drive around and look and see. I think the approach, again, is just to survey the area. I mean, I hung out with the ladies that worked the street in Philadelphia, and there's a couple of corners that, you know, we spent time on. Same kind of ideas before with drug users. You let them see you. You talk with them. You introduce yourself to them. It's not hard to strike up a conversation with people on the street. I'm always amazed at their willingness to exchange information. And so we just used that technique. I sat on the wall and talked while they worked, and said, "Well, you're at risk for sexually transmitted diseases, and have you heard about AIDS? And here's the way you could protect yourself." And then they would tell me things like, "You can't get your customers to use condoms," or, "Can you really get AIDS if you're only having oral sex?" And, well, then how do I protect myself in that way? And really talking about very personalized, again, issues around behavior change. And the women were willing to listen. You know, some of them took condoms, and some said they would use it. Some say they don't. If the issue was complicated by them also being drug users, that added another element that we needed to talk about. I don't find that any of these groups of people that we've really targeted, very focusedly targeted for AIDS education, are that difficult to talk to. They have concerns and fears about what they're doing, but they're doing whatever they're doing to survive. And we just can't judge that. I can't speak to, whether they are good or bad or better people. I just tell them the information. If they choose to use it, they do. If they need more information, they'll call and say, I want to talk to that woman that came in the jeans with the studs on her pants. Or, that kind of thing with it until they get to know you.
Well, let me ask you, if a prostitute says to you, "Well, what do I do if I can't get a customer to wear a condom?" What advice can you give?
Well, they have had in their experience a lot of different ways, I think, of getting customer cooperation. Some men won't use condoms. If they're having oral sex with a prostitute, the prostitute learns techniques of putting on a condom without them necessarily being aware of it. And we try to get other prostitutes who are familiar with that technique to teach them that. And I think that's been very successful in getting done. Sometimes some of them will say, "Well, if we don't, then we can't have sex, or I won't perform certain types of acts for you if we can't use protection." So they have their methods of getting customers to be cooperative with it. Others are saying, I've got to make the money. I'll take the risk, and that's, again, just a reality of their survival methods.
Let me ask you a question I'm sure you've been asked by a lot of the people you've been trying to educate, which is, why do you care?
Well, again, my entire life really has been around trying to give back to the African American community. I was very fortunate to grow up during the time period of great civil activism, civil rights movement, had an opportunity to go to schools that were not all that excited about having African Americans come and had an opportunity for education. I'm very steeped in African American history and culture, and I love my community. I really do. And so going into issues that may seem tough for others is just recognizing the need for community survival. When you look at it from a survival mode, it does really strip away a lot of your fears about going ahead and getting what needs to be done. And nobody else is doing it. That's the other concern that we have, that if we don't do it, why should we expect anyone else to?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rashida Hassan, and she's the co-founder of a group called BABASHI, which is an acronym for Blacks Educating Blacks About Sexual Health Issues. It's an AIDS group that's based in Philadelphia. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Rashida Hassan is my guest, the head of a group called BABASHI, Blacks Educating Blacks About Sexual Health Issues. I'm sure you've thought about this a lot, but what do you think are some of the reasons why there's a disproportionately high amount of AIDS in the black community?
I think that it is solely based on the fact that the minority populations have not been well educated about HIV infection. It has not been presented in ways that make it personal. That much of the information that has been provided leaves questions, I think, for minority populations especially. We have no reason to trust government people with words about if you use condoms, you won't get AIDS. We have no reason to believe that anyone would want to help us in that historically there's been so much negativism associated with a lot of public health efforts. I have not had a single AIDS presentation go without the question, well, what about Tuskegee, which refers to the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. And so people remember that, however distorted.
You should explain what it is for listeners who don't know.
Basically, during immediately after World War I, many men in the area of Tuskegee, Alabama, were knowingly not treated for syphilis. They were observed and studied to essentially get the natural history of syphilis in the human body. These men suffered miserably, were not treated even when penicillin became available. The experiment went for more than 40 years.
And they thought they were being treated.
They attended clinics regularly. They were seen by medical people in an area where having medical care provided was so unusual and so rare that they were happy to participate in the program. It wasn't until I believe 1972, when it was really brought to light and there was a large investigation and that sort of thing. And for those that had survived or their families, there was a monetary settlement of about $20,000. But the devastation that it caused in that community and the memory that has lingered as a result of that experiment has left a very hostile feeling by many blacks about public health issues and having people come in from the outside world and sort of invade them with this information.
Do you hear conspiracy theories a lot when you're out talking about AIDS? Conspiracy theories that AIDS has intentionally been spread in the black community as a form of genocide?
Yes. That, unfortunately, as I say, is frequently the question I'm asked to give my opinion on. Do I think it's genocide? And as I tell them, I don't know. But if it is, it's succeeding, and it will succeed as long as we don't intervene to stop it. I really don't have time anymore to worry about whether it's a conspiracy or not. I'm sure that 30 or 40 or maybe 50 years, someone will write a book and tell us, you know, about their theories of whether it was a conspiracy or not. What I want to be clear about is that there are people available to read the book.
My guest is Rashida Hassan, and she's the head of BABASHI, a Philadelphia-based AIDS group. It's an acronym for Blacks Educating Blacks About Sexual Health Issues. How did Magic Johnson's telling us that he tested positive for HIV, what effect did that have on your group and on the kinds of phone calls you're getting, the kinds of questions you're being asked?
Well, I think overwhelming impact it comes to mind immediately. We do run a client services unit that does HIV antibody counseling and testing. And during the almost 2 weeks immediately after Magic Johnson's announcement, we tested more than 300 people. Many of them were women. Many of them were young. And they were different. It was a different population than we've been seeing in the past.
Everybody's telling Magic Johnson what they think he should be doing.
Yes.
To help educate about AIDS and to help get more government support for AIDS programs. Well, what would your suggestions be?
Well, I think that he's already done what I would like to see him do, and that's continue to speak about it, to be visible in the public eye. I don't want to see him tax himself so that he really is jeopardizing his own survival. But I think that making sure that he has opportunities to speak directly to the community, come to the community, come to Chicago, come to Philadelphia.
I'd like to know what you'd like to see President Bush do about AIDS.
I think I'd like to see him actually understand the AIDS epidemic. I don't believe that he has a very clear picture, or else he really is in incredible denial, and I'd like not to think that he's stupid. I think I'd like to see him attend some of the hospitals and recognize the tremendous burden hospitals are currently under in trying to care for people with AIDS, that it's not just research, that it really is about care and treatment and education. I'd like him to understand the impact of adolescent pregnancy and STDs and how it affects the AIDS epidemic and how it actually has become an integral part of the AIDS epidemic. I'd like to see him come out of the White House in October when the quilt returns to Washington and is spread out in front of the Washington Monument and the acres of land that it covers representing the thousands of people that have died from AIDS. I'd like to see him demonstrate some humanity and understanding and recognizing this epidemic is not only devastating America, but the world.
Rashida Hassan, thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Rashida Hassan is the executive director of Babashi, which is based in Philadelphia. Misinformation about AIDS exists at every level of our society. In Hollywood, actors who are HIV positive are afraid if they go public, they'll never work again. The new group Hollywood Supports was created to fight AIDS discrimination and homophobia in Hollywood. The group was founded by Sid Sheinberg, president of MCA, and Barry Diller, CEO of Fox. My guest is the executive director of Hollywood Supports, Richard Jennings. He's a lawyer and gay activist. One focus of Hollywood Supports will be to work with film executives and producers to end discriminatory hiring practices. Producers feel they can't take the risk of hiring an actor who may get sick during filming, but according to Jennings, some producers are overreacting.
People too often have leapt to assumptions just because someone has tested positive or just because they are either gay or lesbian or presumed to be gay or lesbian, that if you're gay, you're part of this high-risk group and you may have AIDS, and so we're not going to hire you. And that's the sort of discrimination that's arbitrary and based on ignorance that we want to end.
So you think gays are staying even more carefully in the closet now because they're afraid if they come out, people will assume that they might be HIV positive?
I think there are many who are staying more in the closet these days because of that.
Do you think that the way AIDS has been handled in Hollywood is connected at all with the way homosexuality has been handled, with the history of homophobia in Hollywood?
I think that AIDS phobia is inextricably linked with homophobia, that we would not have had the stigmatization of people with AIDS that we have seen for the last 10 years in our society if we did not have the marginalization and stigmatization of people who are gay and lesbian. AIDS carries this connotation that that you know people who have it must be gay or must have gotten it through through homosexual sex. And I think it's very important then to educate people about their stereotypes and their misinformation about homosexuality at the same time as we're educating them about AIDS. And I think Hollywood's portrayals of people with AIDS, which have been practically non-existent, have been interesting. We've seen a couple films. Last year there seemed to be a spate of films of people who were young, who were dying of terminal illnesses, and those illnesses weren't AIDS, but it seemed as though they were using other illnesses as stand-ins for AIDS, because I think there's a great need in our society to deal with the trauma that we have all been undergoing, seeing young people being cut down in the prime of their lives by a disease that still is very much misunderstood.
Now, I had read that the actor Brad Davis, who died of AIDS, that when he was sick, he didn't use his name when he filed insurance forms because he didn't want anyone to know that he had AIDS because he was afraid mm-hmm. he'd never work again. Have you heard that from other people? Do you think that that's happening a lot now?
That has been a fairly common practice by people who have needed to get AIDS drugs. We have a situation where many insurers, when people put in for compensation for AIDS drugs, especially AZT as an example, the insurers will often notify the employers that the employee has been taking AZT, and then the employers put on notice that the person has AIDS. And in order to avoid people finding out, many within the entertainment industry, as well as other industries, have been either trying to find ways to pay for these very expensive treatments on their own, or, you know, going without insurance, and it's been debilitating for people affected by AIDS.
Some people say that it's the closeted executives in Hollywood who are, in a way, the worst, because they're afraid if they did anything about homosexuality or gave a role to someone who was openly gay, they might be accused of being gay themselves. Do you think that that's true?
I think historically there has been a problem that the closet in Hollywood has been one of the worst stumbling blocks for getting gay and lesbian positive images on the screen. I think that was documented in Vito Russo's book, The Celluloid Closet, which is the best history I know of gay and lesbian portrayals on the screen. And I think that it's only recently begun to change. I think there are more people who are willing to greenlight gay and lesbian projects in Hollywood without being afraid that that will, in other people's eyes, identify them as being gay or lesbian. And I have a lot of hope for the future.
I wonder how much faith you have in the American public. You know, like if somebody were to come out either about being gay or about having HIV or AIDS, a lot of their future would depend on how the American public reacted to them if there were someone in front of the camera, someone whose future really depends on being liked by the public. Do you think the public is ready yet? Are you optimistic about that?
I think the public has a lot more information now in the last few years, thanks to talk shows, thanks to some episodes that we've seen on TV lately. And I think if we look at the situation in Britain, where hopefully people are not all that much more enlightened than they are in this country, there were about 18 major stars, celebrities, producers, directors, as well as TV stars, who came out in an open letter to the newspaper in Britain a year ago. And those people have continued to do very well in their careers and remained popular despite their disclosure that they're gay or lesbian.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Richard Jennings is the executive director of Hollywood Supports. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.